en Estados Unidos.
Lo que nosotros sabemos es que las personas que tienen TPS necesitan mucha ayuda y que nosotros necesitamos que estar ahí para pelear porque las personas que tengan TPS que también se queden.
Los hondureños correrán el mismo destino que los salvadoreños y haitianos. Y actualmente miles de migrantes hondureños huyen de su país por la violencia y la falta de oportunidades.
Él no debería de ser así porque él es una persona indeseable. Mejor debería dejar su puesto, porque nosotros los latinos hemos trabajado, no por uno vamos a pagar todos, y debería de darle papeles a las personas necesitadas de estar aquí, porque muchos vienen a trabajar, no solo a sentarse como él.
Si el gobierno de Trump decide terminar el TPS para los hondureños, estos tendrán que cambiar su estatus o abandonar el país para el 5 de julio. Si ignoran la decisión, corren el riesgo de ser arrestados y deportados, reportó el Centro de Refugiados. Desde Los Ángeles, California, soy Rocío Orbach, Hispan TV.
Nuevos datos de la Organización Mundial de Trabajo muestran que el sector informal de la economía mundial está bien representado por docenas de millones de pobres. Jordi Trujols tiene los detalles.
Más del 60% de la población activa a nivel mundial, unos 2.000 millones de personas, tienen un empleo informal, de acuerdo con un estudio presentado este lunes por la Organización Internacional del Trabajo, llevada a cabo en más de 100 países. La mayor parte de la economía sumergida, el 93%, se localiza en los países emergentes y en desarrollo. Por regiones, los empleos informales suponen casi el 86% de los trabajos a los que opta la población activa en el continente africano, seguido por los estados árabes y Asia y el Pacífico, con un porcentaje alrededor del 68%. En Sudamérica, América Central y el Caribe representan más de un 50% de la población activa. Por países varía del 24,5% de Uruguay a alrededor de un 80% en Honduras, Guatemala y Nicaragua, y aún es superior a ese registro en Bolivia. A nivel global, la mayor parte de empleos informales son ocupados por hombres, aunque también afecta a unos 740 millones de mujeres, una gran parte de ellas en países de bajos ingresos.
Y aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RT, de Telesur, del colectivo Más Voces, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV y del diario La Jornada. A nombre de Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
You get up in the morning, if you like to see the sun come up, if you like to have your coffee in the dark, then Free Radio needs you. We need someone to come in, download some shows, put them on the air. To download the shows in the morning, you need to be here at the studio by about 7 o'clock. Send us an email to frsc@freakradio.org and put morning person in the subject line. That way, Democracy Now! Can go on the air at 8 o'clock. Get in touch with us as soon as you can. Let us know what day or days you can be a Free Radio morning person. And once again, that email address, frsc@freakradio.org.
Whenever we're sailing the high seas in Santa Cruz,
we listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.
The Homelessness Marathon radio broadcast brings the voices of the homeless to the nation.
I'm not giving up, and I don't want nobody to feel sorry for me.
Homeless people deserve housing, not shelters.
And we need housing that people can afford.
What we got here is a problem of human beings being treated like refuse. I think probably the solution is some sort of moral awakening.
On Thursday, January 19th, on the eve of the presidential inauguration, the Homelessness Marathon brings a town hall-style discussion about poverty and homelessness for all Americans to consider. That's the Homelessness Marathon, heard Thursday, January 19th, right here on this radio station.
I wish they would do something about getting people off the streets.
And you are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at freakradio.org and 101.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. Coming up for the next 2 hours, it's the May 3rd, 2018 edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, twice weekly show concerned with homeless civil rights and, oh, whatever strikes my fancy. And we'll see if it strikes yours. So stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So I'm going to begin with a couple of stories sent to me by RV full-timers activist Julie Scholl, who I run into frequently at the Red Church meal, which will not be going for the next month. The Calvary Episcopal Church at Lincoln and Cedar is redoing its roof for dealing with internal asbestos problems, or who knows what they're doing. But in any case, it's no meals for the next month, which is a kind of a sad thing for folks who come to the Monday meal, what with meals having been cut off by the Homeless Lack of Services Center 2 years ago. Though Food Not Bombs does continue its Saturday and Sunday meals at 4 o'clock outside the main post office. But here's a story by Julia Sol sent me. Felony abuse charges dropped against Joshua Tree parents living in Desert Shack, CBS, Los Angeles. Let's see how the mainstream media covers it.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sandra Mitchell.
And I'm Juan Fernandez. Our top story on KCAL 9 News at Noon is breaking news on the parents who were arrested after they were found with their three children living in a shed in the Joshua Tree Desert. Felony charges of child abuse against Daniel Panico and Mona Kirk have just been dismissed by a judge.
However, they will face misdemeanor charges, including child endangerment. The family was found living in these deplorable conditions back in February. And, of course, we're going to bring you more information on this story as soon as we get it.
However, if you look at the longer story, which, let me make sure I've got this properly configured. If you look at the longer story that is mentioned on the CBS LA website, the print story reads as follows. Felony child abuse charges were dropped Wednesday against a couple found living in a makeshift desert shack earlier this year on a Joshua Tree property. The felony charges against Daniel Panico, 73, and Mona Kirk, 51, were dismissed by the San Bernardino County DA's office. They were replaced by three misdemeanor counts, each of child endangerment and failure to address truancy. The new charges mean that they will not have to serve time in state prison and can seek employment, assuming they're convicted, of course. The parents appeared in San Bernardino County Superior Court Wednesday, where they pled not guilty to the new misdemeanor charges. The judge also issued a new order which will allow them to contact and visit their children. How nice of him or her. On March 1st, San Bernardino County Sheriff's deputies arrested the couple after going to their property in the 7,000 block of Sunfair Road, where they discovered a makeshift tent and a trailer. Deputies learned that the couple and their three children, ages 11 to 14, had been living there for 4 years without running water, bathrooms, or electricity. The property had mounds of trash and human feces strewn about. Inside a trailer, deputies also found 30 to 40 cats. The children were not enrolled in public school, and there was no evidence they were being educated. However, at the time of the arrest, friends came to the couple's defense, arguing they were good parents who were poor, not neglectful. Dozens of people rallied in support of the couple outside their first court hearing in March, holding signs that read, "Being homeless is not a crime, and poverty is not a choice." "I don't think they're guilty of anything other than being poor," Leanna Monroe, a friend of the couple, said. "The family is a giving, caring, loving family. The children didn't have any obvious injuries and showed no outward signs of malnutrition," officials said. Their attorneys argued that rather than arrest the couple, deputies should have called family services and allowed the matter to proceed through dependency court rather than criminal court. Penico and Kirk are due back in court on June 29th. And here's a little of an earlier story. Friends defend Joshua Tree couple accused of child cruelty and abuse.
In court this afternoon.
A lot of people showed up to defend their character. KCAL9's Peter Dowd is here tonight with a closer look at this case and those parents in court today.
Yeah, Jeff and Lena, when this story broke yesterday, the details were horrifying. Kids living in a plywood shack. But outside court today, the parents and their supporters said people have this all wrong.
I'm wondering why all this has happened.
Daniel Panico appeared in court today and seemed confused about the child abuse charges he and Mona Kirk are facing.
It's ridiculous.
Deputies say the couple and their kids, ages 11, 13, and 14, were living in this plywood shack in Joshua Tree.
I don't think they're guilty of anything other than being poor.
Outside the courtroom, friends of the couple defended them.
This family is a giving, caring, loving family. The kids come over, they're happy, they're always well-dressed, they're always polite, they're very smart, they're always clean.
Leanna Monroe says the family lost their house a few years ago. She says they stayed with a friend, then bought the land in Joshua Tree. But she says the family did not have enough money to build a home, so they built the shack.
I am not agreeing that this is the perfect situation for them to live in, but their home was, where are they supposed to live?
Marcia Custodio says the parents were not on welfare and never asked for help because they feared exactly what's happened.
Their home was important. They need help. They don't need their kids taken away. They need help.
Kirk and Panico are each being held on $300,000 bail, and they're due back in court next week. Their kids are now in the custody of Child Protective Services. Back to you.
So that's a pretty horrendous story. Actually, there's more in the written online version of this KNX 1070 story from CBS Los Angeles. Mentions it's a hovel toppled together with plywood and plastic sheeting. Couple and three children, age 11 to 14. The mother is 51. Who sleeps alongside them in the ramshackle dwelling, only 4 feet high and 10 feet wide. Father, 73, slept in a trailer on the property with dozens of cats. In another vehicle, scraps of plywood that were put together, and then they had a tarp over it to keep out the rain. Blankets were strewn everywhere. Chairs were used to try to hold up the tarp ceiling. A makeshift kitchen was littered with empty bottles, cans of corn, peas, and soup stacked on wooden shelves. Several holes on the property were filled with feces, officials said. It was apparent they had not bathed in days, she said. There was no running water, no electricity, no bathroom facilities. A telephone number listed for the couple in public records was not in service. Deputies believe the family lost their home at some point and has been living on the dirt lot for about 4 years. Initially, the whole family was living in a trailer, and they later built the plywood dwelling. She said temperatures in the desert community regularly reach over 100 degrees during the summer and can drop well below freezing during very windy winter nights. They range from 20 to 30 degrees at night or even lower depending on the wind chill, Bachman said. Temperatures are very cold, and they were basically living outdoors. There was no indoors for them. Friend Marcia Custodio, who we heard from, I think, earlier in the news broadcast, said the family's living situation is clearly not ideal. I'm not agreeing that this is the perfect situation for them to live in, Custodio said, but they are homeless. Where are they supposed to live? She said the family never asked for help, fearing what happened Thursday with an arrest might happen. They're helpless and poor, and they need help. They don't need the kids taken away. They need help. Investigators do not believe the children are being held captive, like another family who lived about 60 miles east of Joshua Tree that made international headlines earlier this year when officials said they had rescued their 13 children. And here's a final story, again, from KNX, probably repeating some of the same details, but it's an example of the kind of slant that the mainstream news media, at least the audio or the video portion, because this is also a video as well as an audio, you can go online and see it, does. Whereas if you look a little deeper, you catch more of the details. There are a few of the details come out, that is to say the fact that these are necessary sort of circumstances for these folks. At least that's what their neighbors are saying. And probably their neighbors know a hell of a lot better than news media, child protective services, deputies, and courts. But let's listen to the news media.
Was released from jail today as they await trial. CBS 2's Tina Patel spoke with the couple who say they've never hurt their children, and now they're getting new support from the community.
Daniel Panico and Mona Kirk are still facing multiple charges of felony child abuse, but they are now out of jail, released after a judge decided they were not a flight risk. We caught up with the couple at the Joshua Tree property where they had been living with their three kids, ages 11, 13, and 14. They admit they don't have a lot of money and have let trash pile up.
It's totally normal, but our place here, it doesn't look totally normal.
They say they used to stay in a trailer, but the water pump broke and they couldn't afford to fix it. Last summer, their kids built a makeshift fort out of some old boxes, and they'd occasionally sleep there.
We're always all together, and they were never in any danger. You know, yes, it's messy, but, you know, they never got hurt. They were always well fed. They were the center of our lives.
The couple is still in shock that they were arrested and their children taken away to stay with relatives. They're not allowed to communicate with them right now.
I want to say it's ridiculous. We didn't do anything wrong.
They're grateful that friends and neighbors are not only standing by their side, but also supporting them, raising more than $20,000 to help them find more permanent housing.
That is so wonderful and
encouraging, and we appreciate and
thank
all those people.
Thank you.
The couple is due back in court on March 13th. They're hoping they'll be able to reunite with their children after that. In Joshua Tree, Tina Patel, CBS 2 News.
And if you look at the video that accompanies that story, you see the, presumably neighbors carrying signs, homelessness is not a crime, these people are not guilty, poverty is not a crime. There are a couple more details in the story, and apparently they were finally released, not just because they aren't a flight risk, but they couldn't afford their $300,000 bail. Kirk's attorney, Elizabeth Crabtree, said she and Panico's attorney will argue next week the couple deserve to be reunited with their children. They'll argue for the charges to be dropped. I don't think there's anything at this point that substantiates abuse, Crabtree said, adding the couple should never have been arrested. And there's more that I think I've read before. We have the sheriff's spokeswoman coming on with Cindy Bachman saying that children didn't appear to have any obvious injuries and showed no outward signs of malnutrition, but as a parent, they had not bathed in days. They were very stinky. Maybe she would offer to let them take showers at her house, perhaps. And again, there's more of the discussion of people rallied at the courthouse. In a jailhouse interview with the L.A. Times, Panico said his family had been torn apart. He and his wife did nothing wrong. We're just minding our own business, trying to raise our three kids on little money. Crabtree said that rather than arrest the couple, deputies should have called Child and Family Services, allowed the matter to proceed, as mentioned before, through dependency court rather than criminal court. Miss Kirk misses her children very much, Crabtree said. She's keeping her head up, knowing she's going to see them again. And that pretty much covers it, because some of what is mentioned in this written story was already spoken of in the video report. Panico and Kirk planned to build a home on the land where they were living, but as time went by, they had used all the money they had for living expenses, wrote Jackie Clear, the friend who started the fundraiser. Any money they got from side jobs and such was spent on their kids, food, and the basic necessities, she wrote. The kids were fed, healthy, and were part of just about any activity or group that was available to the community. And that's, again, from March 6th story. They were never in any danger. California parents who housed kids in desert shack released.
Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex.
Amendment was proposed to make the law state men and women equal. But little did we know just how long the fight would go, and even now we're working on its sequel. So no more debate, because we can't wait. We demand equality today, and it's fighting we must to make the law just. ERA, ERA, ERA. ERA, ERA, ERA. Well, I'm only Adam's rib. Keep me safe up in my crib. This shifty cries while working women labor. Any girl who needs to work should find a man or she's a jerk. And if she don't know her place, who cares what they pay her? We do, so no more debate, because we can't wait. We demand equality today, and it's fight we must to make the law just. Sing it. ERA, ERA, ERA. ERA, ERA, ERA. Said the man who's been laid off, how can I support this stuff? The boss tells me you make more competition. She said, find work if you can, but not just cause you're a man. Let's work side by side in factory and kitchen. So no more debate, because we can't wait. We demand equality today. We must do make the law just. ERA, ERA, ERA. Are you willing to be drafted with the others? She answered, yes, and more. I will not support your war. I will resist and fight beside my brothers. So no more debate, because we can't wait. We demand equality today, and it's fight we must do. Seize the day, shout the word, it's ERA, till the era of equality is greeted. So no more debate, because we can't wait. We demand equality today, and I mean today. And it's fighting we must to make the law just. Sing it.
According to Wikipedia, the Equal Rights Amendment is a proposed amendment, still proposed, to the United States Constitution designed to guarantee equal legal rights for all American citizens regardless of sex. Of course, you can always be droned even if you're an American citizen and put on the presidential assassination list thanks to Obama and his predecessors and successors, but we won't get into that. It seeks to end the legal distinctions between men and women in terms of divorce, property, employment, and other matters. It was originally written by Alice Paul and Crystal Eastman. The amendment was introduced in Congress for the first time in October 1921. That's almost 100 years ago, and has prompted conversations about the meaning of legal equality for women and men ever since. How nice. Conversations, indeed. In the early history of the Equal Rights Amendment, middle-class women were largely supportive, while those speaking for the working class were often opposed, pointing out that the employed women needed special protections regarding working conditions and employment hours. With the rise of the women's movement in the United States during the 1960s, the ERA garnered increasing support after being reintroduced by U.S. Representative Martha Griffiths, Democrat of Michigan, in 1971. It was approved by the U.S. House of Representatives on October 12th of that year, and on March 22nd the next year, 1972, it was approved by the U.S. Senate, thus submitting the ERA to state legislatures for ratification as provided for by Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. Congress had originally set a ratification deadline of March 22nd, 1979, for the state legislatures to consider the ERA. Through 1977, the amendment received 35 of the necessary 38 state legislature ratifications. With wide bipartisan support, including that of both major political parties, both houses of Congress, and Presidents Nixon, Ford, and Carter, the ERA seemed destined for ratification until Phyllis Schlafly mobilized conservative women in opposition, arguing that ERA would disadvantage housewives and cause women to be drafted into the military. So now we have women in the military without the ERA. Four states purportedly rescinded their ERA ratifications before the original 1979 deadline. However, there is no precedent or mechanism within the U.S. Constitution for rescinding. Thus, it becomes a legal question. And in a move that was controversial at the time, Congress passed by simple majorities in each chamber, and President Carter signed a joint resolution in 1978 purporting to extend the ratification deadline to June 30, 1982. But because no additional state legislatures ratified the ERA between March 22, 1979 and June 30, 1982, the validity of that disputed extension was rendered academic. On March 22, 2017, the 45th anniversary of Congress's submission of the ERA to the nation's state lawmakers, and I would say almost the 100th anniversary, 95th anniversary of its being proposed, the Nevada legislature became the first and so far the only to ratify the ERA after the expiration of the original 1979, or for that matter, the contested 1982 revised deadline. With its adoption of Senate Joint Resolution Number 2 and published verbatim in the Congressional Record. And there's a lot more on that in Wikipedia, and hopefully I will find an even better website to review and present these matters to you. Lots of interesting stuff, though, and you got some of it. So now it's time for a few announcements about upcoming events. I would go into the city council agenda that's coming up next Tuesday, but I don't have it yet. Only the privileged council members get access to it. And, of course, there's no way for the citizenry to get any kind of access to actually the mayor who sets the city council agenda. You can try to arrange an appointment with Mayor Chourassis, I suppose, but there's no open process for having the community put something on the city council that they want put on the agenda. That must await another era. But hopefully I should have more information about all that on Sunday when the council agenda, at least part of it, though not the part of it which concerns the claims against the city, will be online. That you have to ask for in a special email to City Hall to get. They still are keeping that from the public. There's another event coming up on Friday connected with a sort of a smear job being done on homeless and disabled people around the recent sexual assault purportedly by a man named Daisuke Muro, 41-year-old Santa Cruz man, who is prominently described and repeatedly described in this Jessica York smear story as homeless. So, for instance, when you have, it's been pointed out by Denise Ehrlich in a letter, or actually in commentary in an earlier story by Jessica York, or perhaps it's in this same story. The story I'm looking at is Public Outcry Follows Sexual Assault at Santa Cruz Town Clock. I'm looking for her. Denise Ehrlich, who's a community activist from Aptos, and part of the movement to support things like needle exchange and other harm reduction activities notes that while Wednesday's attack, this was a week ago Wednesday, I think, was sad and tragic, Elric felt that the accompanying anti-homeless rhetoric was outsized compared to response drawn from recent sexual offenses alleged against everyone from local health care providers and teachers to surfing instructors and correctional officers. You may remember the point is that you don't say housed so-and-so accused of sexual assault, but the word homeless fits in very well with the prejudices of the Sentinel and the hysterical prejudices of groups like Take Back Santa Cruz and looks like the majority of the Santa Cruz City Council. It's also an attack, York's journalism, on the those with mental ill designations. Even though no formal diagnosis has been related to his mental health designation, his being the accused, and I repeat, accused, though quite probable, assailant of this woman at the town clock. Sarah Shinsky, I believe is her story, who kind of joins in the general pile-on against homeless people, who writes, or at least York quotes her as saying, she felt bystander help was slow in coming due to a community that was desensitized to homeless people screaming. I feel as if our town, she writes, is being taken over by the mentally ill, and I will want to be able to help him, but at the same time, we don't have enough patrolling out there to keep us all safe. I guess you have to ask yourself how many times people are being assaulted by folks, whether they're homeless, housed, mentally ill, or simply spiritually ill, like most of the Santa Cruz City Council and other politicians and the entire police structure and Parks and Rec and deputy structure in our town. And, of course, Take Back Santa Cruz, according to York, claims an 18,000-member vigilante group. I use the word vigilante. York does not. They're planning a 7 p.m. event tomorrow, hence I'm discussing this story in the sort of the event section of this broadcast. It's going to start at 7 o'clock at the town clock. I may be there. It's a community engagement walk. It's designed to peacefully assemble to support each other and our local businesses in taking back our streets for a safer downtown. Taking back our streets from whom? Does this mean driving away more poor people from the streets? Under the smear job, phony claim that they are the danger to people out there, that pisses me off. And then, of course, Santa Cruz Councilwoman Rochelle Naroyan, according to York, has posted on her Facebook page a suggestion for urging state lawmakers to support a pending state Senate bill that would establish a procedure for counties to elect to participate in the appointment of a conservator for a person who is chronically homeless, that is, there we go, the H word, and incapable of caring for the person's own health and well-being due to acute and severe mental illness or a severe substance abuse. You might think, oh, that sounds reasonable, maybe. But there actually already is a provision for 5115 and conserving such a person if they are unable to take care of themselves or they are danger to self or danger to others. This, however, says if you have if you're diagnosed having an acute and severe mental illness, and that's undefined, or a severe substance abuse, then your rights can be taken away from you without any showing that you're a danger to yourself, danger to others, or even gravely disabled. That's what Laura's Law has done at a state level and is with a county option buy-in, which has been done by numerous counties, though not yet by Santa Cruz, indicating that if you had a history of being picked up by cops for a psychiatric hold, that is, and have a history of not wanting to take medications which the good doctors have decided you need, even if you've decided otherwise based on things like tardive dyskinesia and other dangerous side effects to these medications, or indications from researchers and other doctors that medicating oneself heavily actually reduces one's chances of recovering from personal crises and so-called mental illness conditions. Anyway, there's an implication here that people who are mentally ill are violent, and that they need to be controlled and contained. And that's simply false in terms of, I think, I want to make sure that I'm accurate in my statistics here. So I'll have to say it is my impression that that's not the case. It's often the claim of those who are supportive of folks with mental health conditions that that's a myth that is spread that has to do with more like the fear of the outsider rather than any kind of actual statistical evidence that there's more violence with people who are given mental health, mental illness designations. So anyway, come on down to the town clock, 7 o'clock tomorrow, if you want to meet the gang that wants to run the homeless off the streets and make sure the mentally ill get locked up and the treatment that they so desperately need. That's probably an unfair statement. There are only a few people who've said that, but one fears that it is a mantra that is being more widely heard and certainly being amplified by York and the Sentinel. Other events upcoming include the Really Free Market coming up Saturday, day after tomorrow, at the Sub Rosa Cafe community space, right outside the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific, right next to the Bike Church. Really Free Market, no money, no trades, everything is free. You bring stuff and give it away. You come and haul stuff away. I did that really for the first time, I think it was last month, maybe it was only a couple weeks ago. Boy, it seems like a few weeks ago. Really interesting stuff, some videos I wanted to see. I think I may have picked up a book. A lot of stuff, very little junk. I mean, check it out. It's from noon to 3 on Saturday. Bring stuff you want to give away and come prepared to take stuff that you want to look over and use. Sub Rosa Cafe, Saturday, 12 to 3. Then UCSC goes on strike. Last week, according to this write-up in the Santa Cruz Indy Media website, UC forced their cuts on us. Instead of working with our bargaining team to address issues of widening inequality and outsourcing, UC's administrators decided to push proposals that only make things worse. On April 26, 2018, our bargaining team gave UC a 10-day strike notice that all service workers will be on strike and patient care workers will strike in solidarity. We will not go backwards. We will fight for a contract that respects us. And so the strike begins Monday, May 7th, 5 a.m. in the morning, goes all day, and it's going to be happening on the 7th, the 8th, and the 9th, apparently. And as I was thinking before, I don't quite know how a limited strike is really going to have a strong effect on, but maybe it will. Seems to me you strike until you get your demands, or you should be prepared not to get your demands at all. But what do I know about labor negotiations? And not a hell of a lot. But, well, that's what's happening up at UCSC. I guess you can go up and support it if you want. And that's what's cooking. Another story from Julie Scholl. Seattle City Council contemplates dedicated funding for vehicle residents. It's May 2nd. Which is, I guess, gosh, just yesterday. As the city grapples with an employee hours tax to help combat homelessness, whatever that is, city staff issued one proposal to pay for safe parking lots for vehicle residents. And here's the story. If there's one rule that translates equally from the public sector to the private citizen is this, it is much more fun to talk about spending money than raising it. Housing advocates and business interests continue to battle a cold war over an employee hours tax through their council member proxies to pay for affordable housing and homelessness services. Not quite sure what this employee hours tax is. But as those arguments continue, the Finance and Neighborhoods Committee issued a detente to contemplate a more pleasant scenario if Seattle did happen into another $75 million a year to combat homelessness and build affordable housing. Woo-woo. Where would it go? While many of the usual and important suspects appear on the list, city staff also included roughly $18.2 million to directly and indirectly support vehicle residents. If passed, this would represent the first investment of any size in several years to help this population of people experiencing homelessness. The proposal, tucked under the heading Safety in Place, includes 97 safe parking spots, case management services, trash removal, and funding for hygiene services. Approximately $5.8 million of the total is earmarked specifically for vehicle residents and would, among other things, help defray the cost of tickets. The program is part of a 20% of the tax revenue set aside for emergency services. The rest will go into housing production and preservation. The news pleased Gene Darcy, a longtime advocate for people living in their vehicles. "It's wonderful," Darcy said. "It's like a miracle. We can really start helping people." Of course, they're just talking about it now, but it does have a nice sound to it. In Santa Cruz, of course, proposals to hurt vehicles has really been up on the city council agenda. Last city council meeting, they passed a proposal to ban vending from vehicles in downtown Pacific Avenue and the adjacent streets. They narrowly put aside, well, actually, it wasn't narrowly, but they put aside briefly a proposal to ban vehicles over 6 feet tall, but that's coming back, I'm afraid, folks, so watch out. Keep your eyes peeled. Also, they're putting in new parking meters, upping parking rates by initially 50% and then up to 400 or 500% if they choose to do so, based on the theory that they want to have a certain number of open spaces that will encourage more people to come park and shop in downtown Santa Cruz, particularly those with money and credit cards, which will now be available to be used in new expensive parking meters, which will also have parking sensors. So you will not be able to park for more than 2 hours if they choose to turn those sensors on. And so if you put money in the meter, it won't work, and you'll just get another hefty parking ticket. But getting back to Seattle and what they're doing there, at present, Darcy, the Reverend Bill Curlin Hackett, and Jennifer Adams, a former vehicle resident and Real Change vendor. Real Change is the homeless newspaper sold up in Seattle. We have our own down here. It's not really a Santa Cruz paper, but occasionally has stories by people like Steve Plaich and Linda LeMaster, called the Street Spirit newspaper. Anyway, these folks are the only people focused on getting help for people living in their vehicles, despite the fact that vehicle residents made up 42% of the unhoused population. Wow, that's quite a percentage. I think we have a much smaller percentage down here who are in their vehicles, who have the advantage of being in a vehicle. According to the 2017 homeless census, that's 2,314 people in Seattle who are not targeted with direct services, unlike people in shelters or encampments. So, of course, that's a bunch of fluff and hokum that people are really targeted with direct services, unless you mean that's at least what the literature says, or the phone lines, the number that they give you to call in where the waiting lists are full or the people aren't answering and so forth. The scofflaw, I don't know what's going on in Seattle, but it seems to me that unless it's much different than most other cities, that's likely to be the case. The scofflaw mitigation team, as Darcy, Carolyn Hackett, and Adams are known, tries to prevent these people from getting expensive tickets for parking or expired tabs and helps shepherd them through the courts. The consequences of such tickets can snowball, resulting in the loss of a home to impound, or even misdemeanor conviction if tickets go ignored for too long. The team relies on an informal network of parking enforcement and court employees to do their work. The team lacks monetary resources as well. They raise money, but donations have largely dried up over the past 2 or 3 years, Darcy said. It's also difficult to keep in touch with vehicle residents who have to live like nomads, constantly moving around the city. The only remaining concession for people living in cars is a lot by railroad tracks in SODO, wherever that is, and that is expected to close this year. Still, 97 parking spaces is a drop in the bucket, said committee chair Councilwoman Sally Bagshaw. Under the proposed plan, the parking spaces would be spread out across the lots holding 6 to 8 cars each. People staying there would have access to case management and hygiene centers, like we're talking, I guess, potable water and drinking fountains and toilets, probably porta-potties. That's what we saw in San Lorenzo Park, but Seattle may be more humane or maybe better financed and more embarrassed, who knows. They could get their vehicles' toilets emptied and help to pay tickets. Curlin Hackett is on the fence. I doubt Seattle can find 97 spaces, Carolyn Hackett wrote in an email, noting that Seattle needs to take a more regional approach. Proposal follows several recommendations from the Progressive Revenue Task Force, a group convened to design the tax and potential ways to spend revenues raised. Darcy wanted funding to help repair vehicles, but it was not listed in the proposal. Many vehicle residences are old and acquire parking violations because they can't move every 72 hours. Of the recreational vehicles that Seattle paid a tow company to dispose of in 2017, the newest was pushing 20 years old. Several date back to a time before the auto industry standardized vehicle identification numbers, obscuring their exact age. Also included in the $78 million set aside for emergency response is money for enhanced shelters and tiny houses, health services, criminal justice diversion, and money to supplement wages for frontline workers. Turnover in these positions prevents people from developing relationships and getting the consistent help they need, said Councilmember Teresa Mosqueda. And that's a story from the, not quite sure what it's from, but it's by Ashley Archibald, and it's headlined, Seattle City Council Contemplates Dedicated Funding for Vehicle Residents, which doesn't sound bad, but the label homeless funding, there's many a slip between the label and the lip, as they say.
I'll tell you a story that happened in April of 1986, an explosion and subsequent meltdown caused damage that never can be fixed. Caused damage that never can be fixed. A nuclear reactor at Chernobyl, like so many others around the globe, did what experts say cannot happen, and like a bomb did explode. And just like a bomb did explode, Chernobyl, I will use all my power to prevent the hour that our earth will live no more from nuclear accident or war. For some, it's a day to talk of heroes, those brave souls that put the fire out. But let's not forget the well-placed cowards that continue to bring these things about. We'll continue to bring these things about. As horror hit the evening news screens and the scope of destruction became clear, the nuclear lobby voiced its new theme, that the only our fear, oh, this is the only problem, is our fear. Chernobyl, I vow I will use all my power to prevent the hour that our earth shall live no more from nuclear accident or war. Through the food chain, and death extends through the years. It comes with the wind and the light rain. It knows no borders
That was Chernobyl by Kristen Lems from the 80s, of course. Actually, maybe a little bit later. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, Freak Radio, the homeless radio station, or I should say the stationless radio station, or the studioless radio station. I also understand we've been having some trouble staying on air because of a transmitter problem. My apologies to all of you who've been looking for us on air and not finding us. We are still available online at freakradio.org, as current listeners have to know if they're actually listening to this. And you can also catch the archives of at least my show at freakradio.org, which is actually where you can go to get archives of other shows. And you can also get schedules and learn how to become a member of Free Radio. But if you go to the Huff website, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, that's the group I work with, there's all kinds of archives of back shows and also current shows. So check it out at huffsantacruz.org. I actually had someone who was doing that today. I got an email that made me feel, hey, at least one other person is listening, and that was good news for me. And here's a reminder, $500 is still sitting in the kitty waiting for you to collect. If you can find us a 10 by 10 space that we can rent for a year with access to electricity, internet, and bathroom, so that we don't go wee-wee on the floor, so to speak. That's $500. Get in touch with Free Radio by going to the website, freakradio.org, or by giving me a call on the Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom line at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And finally, we have a flashback to 1997, at least part of a Bathrop Spears broadside show, which it had a variety of speakers. It featured Just Man Jim Costner, who's been gone for decades now, but not forgotten by some of us. His chat with the FBI, he was an activist with Revolutionary Coalition, one of the groups supporting homeless civil rights. Shitkicker Sean Alimi, whose famous Feed the People Feeding, boldly stood up to endless police harassment on Pacific Avenue. I give reports on Palo Alto and its then attacks on the homeless through its sitting ban. Beggarbacker Becky Johnson, again, an activist who's since left Santa Cruz, but still pokes her nose in occasionally. She was on the board of the so-called Citizens Committee for the Homeless and gives a sort of an expose of that. And there's bits on the medical marijuana struggles of people like, Jane Kaiser, who had her medical marijuana taken away from her forcefully at the court, although she had a doctor's recommendation and needed it for her health conditions. It's a look back. Enjoy it. And check us out on Sunday for the longer show if you're interested. Thanks for listening in.
Good morning. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, and I'm Bathrobe Spear Robert Norse. And you are listening to a show concerned with civil rights for poor people in Santa Cruz, civil rights for the homeless. Civil rights for folks who are a check away from homelessness, and civil rights for all of us who are concerned that if you deny poor people basic rights, you deny everyone basic rights. We've got a lot of stuff today and not enough time to do it, so who knows, maybe I'll do a second tape. Usually we come on every Sunday at 11 o'clock on 96.3 FM. If you have any response to this show, you're invited to call in to 423-4833 or 423-HUFF, which is the headquarters for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And we have a number of events coming up which might interest folks out there concerned with civil rights for poor people. There's, of course, an all-day event happening at San Jose State University today. Most of it has already happened. It's the Social and Environmental Conference at Morris Daly Auditorium. And yesterday, heard some interesting forums over there. Gloria Huerta spoke. Our own David Silva, Green Party candidate, spoke. And today, starting at 1, we've got Protecting Our Forests, Save Our Forests, Barry Bolton, Sierra Club, Redwood Consumer Action, Dave Wise, Eco-Socialist Theory, Walt Sheesby, Green Party, Labor Party Campaign, Leo Seditz. Then there's stuff on welfare reform, Peggy Elwell and Gil Vellegren. Global Economics, The Deadly Embrace, Nicaragua, the World Bank and the IMF, NAFTA and GATT, by more Green Party folks. At 2:30, Crisis in Healthcare, Alcohol Industry Targets the Latino Community, Nuclear Spending and Dumping, Proposed Moratorium on the Death Penalty, and then at 4 o'clock, Tax Resistance by Purusha Obluda, and the Gulf War Syndrome and Environmental Effects. And many of these people are interested in issues of homelessness and fighting the intrusions on civil rights that are now becoming a daily part of the landscape. So if you're interested in going, you can talk to them about a lot of different things. To get to this conference, again, it's the San Jose State University. You park in the 7th Street Garage. It's at 7th and San Salvador on the south side of the San Francisco State University Conference. If you're really interested, give me a call, 423-4833, and I'll try to give you further instructions. Next Sunday, a week from today, the strawberry workers are marching for justice in Watsonville. At 7:30 a.m. from San Jose, buses are leaving. That's not going to help us much. But it, I think it starts around 8 or 9. And again, give me a call if you're interested. The expected a lot of people coming to the United Farm Workers March. I talked to some of the farm workers at the Mumi Abu Jamal benefit rally, which happened on Friday night. Successful rally in spite of a standard bomb threat. I've been told by one of the organizers of the rally, David Dumar, BD, that that's what usually happens at these rallies. They get bomb threats from the Fraternal Order of Police Officers of Philadelphia, who are concerned with seeing Mumia Abu-Jamal killed, executed. He's on death row, as probably everyone who's listening to this broadcast knows, maybe not, for allegedly killing a police officer in Philadelphia in the mid-80s. He's a former Black Panther associated with the MOVE Collective, which was firebombed by the mayor and the police department. And what, some 10 or 11 people incinerated, including 3 or 4 children, all Black people, of course. Mumia himself is Black. So anyway, there's this march on April 13th. The United Farm Workers is going to have a large one in Watsonville. And I believe that's 8:30, 9 o'clock over there. Try to give you more information if you give me a call on that. Then on Monday, that's Monday the 14th. No, that's Monday the 7th, April 7th. We're going to be doing some tabling down on the mall right across from the Cinema 9 Theater, and I invite anyone who's listening to this broadcast to join me from 4 to 6. Tabling about a very important issue, the rights of jurors to make a decision independently of the strictures, prejudices, biases, and prosecutorial pressure conveyed by the judge's instructions. Jurors, in other words, have basic rights to express their sense of the ultimate justice of a situation, regardless of how the judge tries to hem in the jurors with restrictions and tell them that they have to obey even unjust laws. I'm going to present information to the public about the Fully Informed Jury Association and the Fully Informed Jury Amendments that are going through the different state legislatures or happening in some states, and that are actually a part of the state constitutions, which require that judges inform jurors that they have the right to decide both the law, the justice of the law, and the relevance of the facts, and the relevance of any other considerations, for that matter, that are going on in any particular case. And this is particularly pertinent for homeless people, and also for people involved who are victims of the drug war, because a lot of jurors don't believe in the justice of jailing people, for example, for smoking marijuana. But they get into the court situation and they are told by the judge in an imposing and official tone that they have to act a certain way regardless of their beliefs if they find the guy was smoking the joint or if they found the homeless person was sleeping outside. And they aren't told the penalties that these people suffer. And attorneys are instructed that if they do tell the penalties, they will suffer legal penalties themselves. So, in essence, a juror is asked to be a part of a machine, of a juggernaut, which doesn't render justice, but which enforces unjust laws and unjust prosecutions in many cases. And this is what's happening in Santa Cruz in the next 2 or 3 months. We have a dozen activists who are going to trial, and not just facing $162 fines under the sleeping ban, they're facing up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine per charge for such things as sleeping once at City Hall. That's Sandria Roth. That's the little-used misdemeanor section of the Mike Rotkin, Cynthia Matthews sleeping ban. I give you the name of the mayor, actually two mayors, our former mayor and our present mayor, both of whom are on the city council now, because they support this law. They're the ones who blocked any discussion of it in December at the only city council meeting where anything was ever put on the agenda around the sleeping ban to reform it in a significant way. So we have a lot of cases coming up that jury, what's called jury nullification, that's what this is all about, will have a real pertinent effect. Sandria Roth's facing a misdemeanor sleeping charge and also another charge of sleeping where she violated the injunction since dissolved, again passed by Cynthia Matthews and Mike Rotkin last year, which attempted to drive away the 7.5-month City Hall Sleepers protest vigil from City Hall and failed. But and they did result in a number of arrests of people for peaceful First Amendment protected demonstrations in a clear attempt to intimidate and chill them. I guess they're chilled enough sleeping outside, but chill them some more so they wouldn't come back and demonstrate. And that is still being pursued by the district attorney and by the city attorney, or the, in this case the assistant city attorney, Tony Condotti. It should also be noted, and very significantly, last Thursday the DA announced he was going to attempt to retry the City Hall sleep crime chain gang lockdown case. That's the case of seven people who chained themselves with chains and padlocks to furniture and material about the city council chambers in protest of the city's anti-homeless sleeping ban and its refusal to allow a democratic debate on that issue, and particularly in light of the fact that there were less than 30 legal spaces for over 750 homeless people, criminalizing the overwhelming majority of them at night after 11 o'clock for sleeping or for covering up with blankets, which is the second section of the sleeping ban. And these people went through a trial. They were tried on two charges each: disrupting a public assembly and trespass at city council. And the result of that was the jury hung 11-1 and 10-2 for conviction, but it hung, which means that they could not reach unanimous agreement, and therefore they said, we can't give a verdict. And that's cost thousands and thousands of dollars, that process. It took 6 days. It was a very long trial. They want to go through it again. And it looks like they're going to go through it again sometime in June. And that's not just taxpayer money being spent. It is the prosecutor and the entire court system being mobilized to support the ego of Mike Rotkin, the ego of the city council, the ego of the people who are simply unwilling not only to put anything on their agenda, but to be publicly embarrassed by protesters that they haven't put something on their agenda. Well, they may find that this action they're doing embarrasses them and the entire community far more, because the facts about the rights of poor people, about the conditions of poverty in Santa Cruz really have to be faced, and they are being faced by poor people every day. But the rest of us who are one step up from that will now have an opportunity to really bring this issue dramatically to the fore. Well, we have it at any rate, but the absurdity of another, a second trial for the sleep crime chain gang lockdown folks is hopefully something that will awaken the conscience of the public and draw some outside support from other activists in other parts of the state concerned about this issue. So we have a FIJA table, fully informed jury amendment, jury nullification table, happening from 4 to 6 on Monday in front of the Cinema 9. If you want to help out, come on down. We can use your assistance. If you want to help out some other day, give me a call at 423-HUFF. Really be grateful for that. And I think that we can get this information out so the jurors can know that in numerous cases, they don't have to say guilty just because a judge has told them to. They are the final arbiters. They are the fourth branch of government. They are the people that make the decision as to whether to send the sleep crime chain gang lockdown people, for instance, to jail for a year on each of these counts. That's the maximum sentence. Probable sentence is 3 months because the judge, Tom Kangaroo Kelly, as I call him, is insistent on, he doesn't want a jury trial. 96% of cases are plea bargained away. Another percentage there are don't go to jury trial but go to a trial in front of a judge. But these defendants and many political defendants insist upon their jury rights. And if they, as they should, But if they do that, their jurors need to be properly informed, or else it's all to no avail. So that's what we're doing on Monday. Then on Tuesday, I'm going to be at City Council. The Santa Cruz City Council is meeting down there at City Hall. It's at 809 Center Street. And they have their usual oral communications period. And I'm hoping that later in the show we can get a brief update from David Silva, who does a sort of an analysis of the City Council agenda at greater depth than I can, because he's conversant with the technical details of the money appropriations. So when City Council decides it's going to spend $300,000 to pay a contractor and so forth, what it's really saying is we're not spending this money on a campground. We're not spending this money on opening a bathroom 24 hours at night. We're not spending this money on a mediation process rather than the police force. So the significant choices are often buried and need a sort of expert excavation, and that's what David Silva does very well. We'll see if he's able to do that. He's in the process of moving this week, so he may not be able to make it on the air. But you can make it on the air. If you come down to City Council at 7:30 on Tuesday the 8th, you will go on television if you speak between 7 and 7:45 at oral communications. Don't expect there'll be a long line. You're allowed to speak for 3 minutes before they cut you off. You can talk about any topic not on the agendas. That's most everything. So come down and speak and bring a friend or two to talk about basic injustices. Jim Costner is going to be there talking. I'm going to be there talking. Jim Costner is one of the defendants in the sleep crime chain gang lockdown case. And he's also been the victim of a recent attempt by the FBI to frighten and chill his free speech. He was visited in the dead of night at 10:30 on Thursday night by 5 FBI agents and 2 local police officers, by his account. And you're going to hear him talk about that situation later in the show, in a pre-recorded interview, which I had yesterday with him. The FBI apparently is, again, repeating its expeditions of the 40s and 50s against political dissidents, this time using bombings as their keynote. So, Tuesday night, join me and Jim Costner at City Council. Then at 6:30 on Thursday, we're going to have an organizing meeting to help defend activists such as Jim Costner, who are being attacked, not just investigated by the FBI, but being tried. Jim faces 2 years in jail under this sleep crime chain gang case when he goes to trial in June, plus a bunch of other activists, Sandria Roth, Pat Ring, Daniel Hopkins, the father of the City Hall Sleepers Vigil, Sean Alimi, now back in town and working with a scaled-down Feed the People operation, which now apparently is going to feed once a week because they couldn't find a certified kitchen for the other four of the five days that they usually feed at Cathcart and Pacific. So we're going to try to do a series of support demonstrations and educational forums and organizing efforts on behalf of these protesters, and also around the basic issue of our old favorite, the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz. It's a tiresome issue to keep hearing again and again, no pun intended. However, it's a real one. You know, it happens every night. It's particularly intense during the summer, because during the summer there's no winter armory shelter, and we have a city council that is engaging in the most preposterous, hypocritical gestures at their homelessness special council sessions, which, for example, they held back on March 4th, but they won't discuss the real issue and they won't take real action. And so we need to take real action. And if you're interested in that, come at 6:30 on Thursday to a meeting. If you want the details on how to get there, give me a call at 423-4833. This isn't a matter of secrecy. It's a matter of I've forgotten the address. It's at Jim Costner's house. Who knows? You may meet the FBI there. It could be very educational. Hey, it's April 5th, 1997. I'm here with Jim Costner and a number of other activists. But Jim, particular attention to you because you're been working with a group called the Revolutionary Coalition, the Coalition to End the Sleeping Ban, the HUF, groups concerned with homeless rights and with broader issues. And indeed, last night you were helping put together a benefit for Umi Abu Jamal, a prisoner of conscience on death row. You've recently had some interesting encounters with the federal government. What happened with that?
Last Thursday night, the 5 federal agents and 2 police officers came to my house at about 10:30 at night, came knocking on the door, said they wanted to speak with me, and asked if I would come out to speak with them. I didn't let them in the house, and I did go out with them with a friend of mine, a witness, at which point they interrogated me about several questions.
What were they interested in knowing about?
They said that they had gotten confirmation from somebody in the community that told them that I was working with people down in Watsonville in a militia group and doing training down there, which is the farthest thing from the truth, which I reiterated to them that I am not involved in militia groups and in no way am advocating bombings, which was another concern. They said, the FBI agent said that they were concerned, the federal government at this point in time and throughout nationwide are concerned about bombings of federal buildings and bombings of different, you know, bombings in general, and that they were doing just kind of a checkup on people who might have a tendency to be proponents of that type of political action.
Did they say who is directing them in your direction?
No, of course they wouldn't say that, and even if I asked them that, they wouldn't say that. They wouldn't give that information. But they basically, I think it was a show of force, and I think it was, for me, it's more of a validation of that we're in America. It's more of a validation for the fact that the movement is growing again in this country around many different fronts, and that as we rise, they will move to try to infiltrate us and divide and keep us conquered. And for me, it's a question of unity, and it's a question of not backing down.
Now, you've never had any involvement before from federal agents coming to your house or talking to you?
No, this is the first time that federal agents have come to my house, and I hope it's the last time, although I don't imagine so.
How long did you talk to them for?
Just about 15 minutes.
Did they ask you any other questions, or did you do most of the talking? What happened?
They asked just a few questions just about, you know, did I advocate, they expressed their feelings or concerns about the Oklahoma City bombing and the Jimmy McVeigh trial that's going on right now, and that the federal government is concerned about bombing. And I almost laughed because for the federal government of America to be concerned about bombing and for the federal FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation individuals to be concerned about bombing, I find one of the most typical.
They found the bomber of Judy Berry.
I didn't ask them that, but I certainly thought about all the bombing they just got off with in Iraq, and I thought about all the bombing they did in Vietnam, and I thought about all the bombing they did in Panama and Grenada, you know, and I thought about all the bombing they've been doing in Somalia just recently in the 90s, you know. So,
did you mention this to them?
No, I didn't mention this to them. In fact, I had to swallow.
You should have inquired whether there were some bombers in their midst.
I had to bite my tongue, you know. But I did tell them that I was a proponent of the liberation of humanity, and that I was an advocate of all bombing being simultaneously stopped on this planet. And that's the only point of conscience I made to them. Otherwise, I just acted like, you know, that I didn't really want to talk with them, really.
They offered to put you on the payroll, Jim.
They didn't offer me any money yet, so I was kind of disappointed. You know, I guess I'm not that effective yet. You know, maybe if maybe a couple more years down the road, maybe they'll start offering some bribes, and then I'll really feel like I'm doing some, you know, doing some work in the community.
Did they mention anything about people in jail and you or your actions with the Revolutionary Coalition in terms of demonstrations in town or anything of that sort?
No, the three groups that I work with presently, they didn't ask anything about any of those groups or any of those individuals. They just were concerned about militia and my involvement in militia. And I reiterated to them, as anybody else, that I'm not involved in militia groups, you know. But at the same time, I think it's funny for them to talk about being concerned with militia groups when I see the biggest militia group in America is the real problem, and not the smaller militia groups throughout this country who actually, for the most part, are just taking a stand to be autonomous people in America, which I thought we all were supposed to be given a right to.
Now, did they ask you if you owned a weapon?
They didn't ask me if I owned a weapon, although they did. There was a point in conversation where that came up. And I essentially didn't answer it, really. I answered it in a way that I didn't answer it.
Now, people have told you, I among them, that the best thing to do when the FBI comes to your door is to show them the door, so to speak, and say, it's an interesting door, you get to look at this side, I look at the other side. But your approach was somewhat different.
Yeah, this is what all the people that I talk with about this issue keep telling me, that you're not supposed to talk with Federal Bureau of Investigative, you know, you're not supposed to talk with the FBI, and I can appreciate those sentiments, but I guess for me, is because I recognize what historical time it is, because I recognize that the movement is coming in this country, and because I recognize there'll eventually be a revolution in America, that I think that I have, you know, nothing to hide. You know, I'm not I'm an innocent man. I have nothing to hide from people. I'm not in favor of hurting people or causing disruptions. What I'm in favor of is people unifying and working together in a focused way that actually does ultimately make transformation in this country and to stop the government from doing repressing people and to eventually end that repression. And so for me, the reason why I think it's important that we talk with the FBI, but keep in conscious that they are paid by, trained by, and funded by the United States ruling class. Keeping in mind that and not wanting to offer information that could get people hurt or things like that, be conscious of that. But I think it's important that they see who the human being is that they're supposedly scared of or threatened by or wanting to hurt. I think it's important that they're able to look, you know, that we're able to look them in the eyes and from a human way. And even because it might have to make it might not make an effect now in the short term, but in the long term, when things are really going down in this country, and people are standing up for their freedom, and the government does move to send those people to stop that, there might be a factor in terms of how many people of the oppressed who they come in contact with who really come from a loving and a caring and a kind place. That might play a role down the road that I think is important. So I think it's important that we don't just shun the cops completely, that we at least that we talk with them as human beings, but that we don't offer them information that can hurt the movement, and that we don't think of them as like on our side, because they're not on our side until they stop putting us in cages, and they're not on our side until they denounce the same man that they work for now.
We also have with us another activist, Sandy Roth, who is going to trial. Actually, you two are being tried together. Will be tried together in a retrial of the chain gang lockdown case. People arrested for peacefully demonstrating at City Council last September 10th to dramatize the plight of homeless people here in Santa Cruz in terms of the realities of a sleeping ban that punishes 160
repression,
prescribes $162 fines and 30 sleeping spots for 750 people. Anyway, Sandy, what's your thought about this? When the FBI comes to your door, what are you going to do?
Oh.
And what militia do you belong to?
I'll never tell. It's the Robert Norris militia.
Better put a disclaimer in on that. By my gums. Do you have any comments or suggestions? You've been involved with Headwaters activism and other groups throughout the, you know, obviously subversive groups of that sort. As a seditious rebel, what is your perspective on this?
No, I'm not seditious. Yeah, I wouldn't talk to anybody who came to my door, really. The Federal Forest Service agents came to my door one time. That was pretty funny. They were investigating a forest fire, but I wouldn't talk to them.
Why do you recommend this? What about Jim's perspective on, you know, kind of appealing to their hearts, their higher consciences, and, you know, their broader affiliations with the human race?
Don't they have to give those up to join the FBI?
Well, anything else you want to add, Sandy? Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Robert.
Anybody who's interested, by the way, in getting involved with the homeless movement or with what? You're involved with broader movements, Jim. Any? You would like to put out a commercial for anything you're doing?
I'm working presently with the Emergency Committee to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal, and you can get in contact with people through 421-9250. Also, I'm working with the Big Mountain Alliance to stop the relocation of the Navajo and elders out in the reservation in Arizona. So if people want to get involved in that struggle, which is very crucial because ethnic cleansing today is going down in reservations in America. And that's a very serious reality that needs to be addressed and ultimately needs to be stopped as well. And once again, the federal government is responsible and guilty of perpetrating those crimes.
Okay. And, of course, if you're interested in the sleep crime trials, you can call Jim at 421-9250. They're due to resume, I believe, later this month with the trial of Pat Ring. I'm not quite sure what his court date is. And also you can give me a call at Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUFF.
Long live free radio.
Yes. Finally, the Mumia Abu-Jamal rally last night was something of a success in spite of a bomb threat. Now, what was that about?
Well, that was obviously about the local power structure and the FBI agents who were still... this is the night after they came to my house. They were still here the next day because we saw them in front of the police station. And the fact that there's a bomb threat during the Mumia Abu Jamal event is just the reality that the power structure will go to any level to try to break up the unity amongst the people.
Are you accusing the FBI of doing a bomb?
Troubles to a man who put you down. If you're hoping to find a part of your mind that'll turn your life around. If you want to be like all the rest, and you're looking for someone who always knows best. If you want to change without having to think, don't talk to me about it. The opinion of your doctor cures more than it kills. If you feel that in your desperation, you'll settle for your mind's obliteration. If you don't mind spending your life in the clink, don't talk to me about it. No. Future's at stake. There's a step I cannot make you take. If the days ahead don't make you brave, you can talk yourself into an early grave. But if you're looking for the freedom that only truth can provide, if you're willing to put aside what you've heard and keep an open mind, if you want to try your wings and fly, I'll tell you once, so did I. And when I listen, you'll know my interest is real. I know how you feel.
And that was Morgan Firestar, long-term Berkeley and Santa Cruz activist against psychiatric abuses, in one of her songs from her album, Singing Against Shrinks. Morgan killed herself last year in June of 1996. We miss her. Before that, you heard from Les Miserables, the musical, or Les Mis, Can You Hear the People Sing, singing the song of angry men. For all of you music buffs who want to pick up on those songs. And you are listening to 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Bathrobe Spears Broadsize. Bathrobe because that's what I wear when I go to political demonstrations championing the rights of poor people to sleep at night under the laws which we now have, which don't allow them to do that. They get arrested if they sleep outside, and there is no legal place for almost all of them. Almost all of them are illegal at night.
The streets here talking to the people. Yes, sir. What's your story?
The cops are sitting out here scrutinizing people, just staring at them. They pull up in their cars and they sit there and they look all like, what are we doing here? What reason do we have to be here? Because we don't spend money, or we do spend money, but not as much money as they would like to see be spent.
We don't pay rent.
No, I pay rent. I live here. I live in Bonnie Town. I've been here for 4 years. I'm a Cabrillo College student. I get straight A's. I'm on the honor roll, and the cops still scrutinize people.
Your first name is?
Thomas.
Thomas, have you been actually been hassled by police in terms of tickets and interrogation?
No, just scrutinization and fucking, just like mental harassment, really, man. It's kind of bad. I don't think they have any right to be coming up here searching kids because they're smoking cigarettes. Mm-hmm. I think that's illegal search and seizure, but they're bending the laws. They're doing what they want to do. They're, I don't know. I think it's ridiculous. Why aren't they down in the flats busting heroin and cocaine dealers? Why are they up there fucking with hippies, man? Why don't they just, because they got guns and we don't, and they're afraid, but they want to earn their money.
Anybody getting any sleeping tickets or tickets for being outside?
I got a ticket in San Francisco for camping.
How long ago?
I don't know, but I got a warrant there for it.
Like, was it within the last year?
Yeah.
And what was this, in a concealed place or in an open place?
It was concealed. It was a camp that was totally camouflaged.
And was this what, a Caltrans type bus? Or?
No, dude. They were sweeping the park. I hate that shit.
Okay. Anything happening here locally I should know about?
Nope.
No. All right. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
4 o'clock here, and I see four police officers in there. In a one-block area, two of them on bicycles, two of them on foot. Of course, we have the Cat and Canary on the street display happening over here. And we have two individuals that look a little unsavory sitting on a bench. Your name, sir?
Sean Olivi, sir.
And your name?
Shane.
Do I get a hug? No,
maybe.
All right, that's what I can see. She's rough, she's tough. Don't mess with me.
You get a hug from me.
You want a hug from me? There we go. No, you don't. It's mud wrestling on the streets. So what's up with Feed the People? Are you feeding or is it a once a week thing now?
At this point, it'd probably be a once a week on Tuesdays and until we keep adding on to it. We have one kitchen, which they allow us to be there once a week. And we're going to see if we can keep it going.
Okay.
We might not do it this Tuesday, but the following Tuesday definitely.
Comments here. I see the law is taking good note of all the people sitting on the sidewalk.
A couple nights ago, you missed it. Tuesday night, so I had a little shenanigan with a little stand up between myself and a couple of the police officers.
Well, tell me about it. What happened?
Well,
and we'll get Shavy's view of what really happened.
Well, Shaver was walking with me. We were a little late.
I was standing right there the whole time watching it happen.
Yeah, what happened was I was walking down Pacific Avenue towards the hippie corner, and I saw this cop yelling and screaming at the kids. And there was a sister leaning against the bike rack.
Uh-huh.
And he was ordering her to get off. That's against the law. And then I yelled back, said, "Don't get off, sister." And there's nothing wrong with leaning against the bike rack. If the bikes can lean against the racks, so does the people.
Yeah, so the cop was like, you know, stay out of this. Don't mess around. This is not your business. Trying to, like, you know, shove him off.
Who was the cop? I forget his name. Fayette something?
Lefebvre,
yeah, one of those guys. Whatever his name is. He's a total egotistic maniac. Eric Seeley tried to pull me aside. Calm the situation.
The older Seeley?
Negative, the younger Seeley. Eric, yeah. Younger Seeley tried to pull me aside, talk to me, and it was already too late. You know, I was yelling top of my lungs. I was threatened that I was going to be arrested for disturbing the peace. I said, on the contrary, I think you're disturbing the peace, because if you're yelling at the kids, if you have permission to yell at the kids, I have permission to yell at you.
What time of the day was it?
Just about...
That night, it was 7:30?
Yeah, about 7:30.
Did the kid appreciate your intervention? Or?
Oh, yeah. They were like getting closer and closer, and the cops got nervous and said, "Hey, back off.
I to protect him because, you know, he was protecting them.
How big was the audience? How many people were involved?
15, 20 people.
Yeah.
So it was...
You get a ticket?
Of course not. I was yelling top of my lungs, and I invited him like to a friendly spar. So are you threatening me? You know, like, total ego.
He just loved it. He was trying to, you know, fight, get into a fight, get the people roused, and he wasn't. He was just, you know, stating that he didn't like what was going on, he didn't like the law, and, you know, the cop was scared. He thought he was, you know, going to start a fight or whatever. So he kept saying, "Are you threatening me? You're threatening me?" You know, he reached for his baton and. So Sean, like, put out his hands, you know, to arrest him. The cop, like, jumped back for a second. He got scared. He thought he was going to beat him up.
What was the end result of all this?
The end result, they called the sergeant, which was Sergeant Vogel. He came down. He pulled that cop aside. So what happened, I guess the officer told him his view. He said, "Sean, come on, man, let's talk." So we talked for a while, and I told him...
Did the woman leave the bike rack, or was she still there?
No, she was still there, because I was there.
Very good.
I told Vogel, you know, what's, you know, this, it's not right. I mean, they're not sitting. Even if they're sitting, during the time down here, I'm feeding people, don't bother me or the kids, because I'll be in your faces, you know, like you wouldn't believe.
It'll be much less time, it appears, with only one feeding a week.
Yeah, but we'll see what happens. You know, things are going to change. Just, you know, find us with more kitchens. We need more kitchens, you know. More kitchens,
so actually,
more volunteers.
You out there in free radio land, if you know of a kitchen that can be used by Feed the People, and how many hours do you usually have to take in the kitchen?
Approximately about maybe 3 hours. 3 hours, and we need a storage area, and we need possibly, if a cheap car can be donated, you know, I'm considering
your
car.
Give a call to
425-FEED, 425-3333.
So call Sean at 425-3333 to help continue the feeding operation, which is now being cut back at Cathcart and Pacific from 5 days a week to one night a week.
Yeah, at this point.
Sergeant.
Yeah. Oh, this, to finish the situation with Sergeant was, I told him that, you know, do you believe in God? And he said yes. And I said, I'm doing what Jesus would do otherwise. You know, feed the people and stuff like that. He just started laughing and said, "Sean, you know what? You're right." And just like.
Did the cop get instructed to stop harassing people leaning against bike racks?
Actually, they made sure that during the time I'm around, that nobody gets hassled. And
that'll help us like 2% of the time, I suppose. Well, that's a beginning, right?
Yeah, that's a beginning. But the fact was, the night after, the same cop was down here. They opened the door to get out of the car. They saw me sitting right there, and then they just closed the door. They didn't come out.
So you are, in fact, causing terror and consternation among police officials throughout the block.
No, I don't know about terror and consternation. This is about respect. I think it's, you know, they respect.
You're just not going to mess around on our turf, you know. This is, you know, open area for the people. We're free. We can do what we want, and we're not going to take it
anymore. Actually, what it's about is... what I saw this morning down there, they have all these racks of clothing outside, and a lot of people stand there and block the passageway. I was trying to go through, and there was like two or three instances which I had to wait, and I had to like ask people, please move out of the way. I mean, if it was happening here at the hippie corner,
you get arrested for it. But if it's for the business owners, you know, they're making money off of it, it's okay. Total block off.
You move along with the bullhorn. Please clear the sidewalks.
Yeah.
Well, normally I'd say, you know, watch out. White body coming through.
Thank you, Sean Alimi and Shavy.
Gruen.
Yes. And that was the report from Sean and Shavy on the sidewalk outside Cat and Canary. It's been pointed out to me that for every weekend until the summer, midsummer, according to actually David Silva is my source of information on this, the merchants are going to be putting their dress racks and knickknacks out on the sidewalk in a great number, strewing the area with their commercial debris and blocking the sidewalk with their little stands and impediments. Now, it might be time for a squad of us to move along and start issuing tickets for these clear violations of the free passageway and the right of the community to have a sidewalk not cluttered with commercial nonsense. Of course, who knows what the merchants will do. They're known to be, in some cases, armed and dangerous, or at least they have the support of the police force that has that reputation and appearance. But indeed, that's what they're doing. And in fact, this whole business of clearing people away from the sidewalks, which happened in Santa Cruz in 1994 and is still happening as the downtown is being built out, it's illegal to sit down on the sidewalk 10 feet from a business at the current time. And that means most of the sidewalk is technically a verboten for sitters. If you sit down in downtown Pacific Avenue or in any other commercial district of the area, you are likely to get creamed by these laws. And people have been. And they're currently not on appeal, unfortunately. There was a case several years ago
being appealed by Margaret Marr in the Eric Marcus case, but that unfortunately sort of has reached a standstill. I think Eric left the country. So there is an anti-sidewalk sitting law in effect, and there is a bunch of merchants who are throwing their debris out. And debris and, you know, commercial stuff is fine, but where even human beings want or have to sit down or they have a live community going on the streets, that's apparently forbidden. This is also happening in other cities. In Palo Alto, as you may have heard me talk about in past shows, Palo Alto on, I guess it was the, well, it was the end of March, they passed the no-sit, no-lie law along a 10-block area of the main drag there, University Avenue. And that goes into effect in April. And I believe that folks in Palo Alto are planning a demonstration, a CD demonstration in mid-April around that issue. If you want to get involved with that attack on their sit-lie law, give me a call at 423-4833. I'll try to be more specific about it. In fact, actually, I have an article here which I'm going to read you from the Mercury News of April 2nd. Critics launch drive to overturn Palo Alto sidewalk law by Deborah King. Opponents of Palo Alto's so-called sit-lie ordinance hope to challenge the law at the ballot box, they announced Tuesday. A new group called CALM, Citizens Against Legalized Meanness, said it will begin a campaign to gather enough signatures to place a referendum on the November ballot. The sit-lie ordinance is wrong, and if it is allowed to stay, what other ordinances can the city council come up with to get rid of homeless people, said Daniel Day, who works at Palo Alto's urban ministry, also a member of CALM. At least let the people vote for it. The sit-lie ordinance, approved by a 6-2 council vote March 24th, prohibits sitting or lying on sidewalks on University Street between Cowper and High Streets between 11 a.m. and 11 p.m. It will take effect at the end of this month, April. Proponents say safety is an issue because people sitting or lying on sidewalks could cause pedestrians to trip and fall. Critics say that the argument is merely a way of selectively targeting panhandlers and the homeless and that no such complaint has ever been documented. CALM has 21 days to gather 2,207 signatures. Palo Alto residents who are registered voters, said City Clerk Gloria Young. If the group is successful, the measure would probably appear on the November 4th ballot. Though CALM spokesman Lawrence Duncan acknowledged it would be difficult, he said he was confident that the group could gather the necessary signatures. Duncan plans to target areas such as Lytton Plaza, Whole Foods Market, the train station, and, with permission, Stanford Shopping Center. Councilman Gary Fazzino, who supported the ordinance, said he thinks the measure, if it gets to the ballot box, will fail. I believe the community is behind us on this, he said. This is a town that's very sensitive to protection of civil liberties, and we clearly walk a fine line when we deal with an issue about this. I feel very comfortable about the action we took. Fazzino added that seniors particularly have been concerned about navigating around people sitting or lying on sidewalks. And while Day said there are no police reports about such problems, downtown merchant Odette Mock said she once helped a woman who tripped over someone on the sidewalk and skinned her knees. She was in a rush, and I guess she didn't notice him. She didn't have her glasses on, and she tripped, Mock said, noting that the woman refused to file a report and never returned to the store. The petition effort doesn't preclude the possibility of a legal challenge. However, in October, a similar law in Seattle survived a challenge when the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed that the law didn't violate freedom of speech. Assuming Palo Alto's law is constitutional, ACLU representatives have said they'll wait and see whether the ordinance is selectively enforced before deciding whether to challenge it in court. Fazzino said the council will receive annual reports about how the measure is being enforced. If we learn or believe a particular population is being challenged, we'll adjust the ordinance accordingly. The last time Palo Alto residents challenged the city council, that's Critics Launch Drive to Overturn Palo Alto Sidewalk Law by Deborah King in the San Jose Mercury News of April 2nd, 1997. And that talks about the initiative drive. I was earlier talking about a CD drive, demonstrations against this law by simply sitting down, as happened in Santa Cruz when people in great numbers challenged the Kennedy-Coonerty Law, which was the law which made it illegal to sit on the sidewalk anywhere in a commercial district. That law was challenged by people who turned out in such great numbers that the police stopped arresting them, and then overturned by the court and replaced by another Kennedy-Coonerty law, which made it illegal to sit 10 feet from a shop, 50 feet from an ATM or a change dispersing machine, or 4 feet from a water fountain or a payphone. That's the current law we have in Santa Cruz, which is being enforced rather viciously and selectively by cops who want to see, like, for example, young people and the hippie-type folks and punks gone from downtown. or not gathering in groups. Different cops have different agendas. So there's a positive drive being launched in Palo Alto to overturn their sit-down, go-to-jail law. And if you want to get involved in that, give me a call at 423-4833. There's also, unfortunately, action happening in the other direction in San Jose and Mountain View, both of whom have city council meetings on the same evenings as our city council meeting. At least they do this coming Tuesday. And I'm going to read you the story by Holly Heiser from the Mercury News of yesterday, April 5th, about what's happening in San Jose and Mountain View. I'm not going to read all of it because it's pretty clearly slanted against poor people and homeless people and doesn't give the other side. They apparently didn't even bother to contact homeless advocates. I've talked to Holly Heiser on the phone before because I wrote an editorial for the San Jose Mercury News against the Palo Alto sit-lie law. And we talked about it at length, but she didn't get back to us to talk about this new law. It's too bad that we can contact her and get in the paper on it, because somebody should. You can always write a letter to the paper, by the way, listeners. You can always write a letter to the San Jose Mercury News telling them you don't think it's appropriate for laws to criminalize poor people, that it doesn't do any good, and that it's a form of abuse against the poor. Anyway, this is her story. Panhandlers obey new laws, leaders say. The beggars haven't gone away, but ever since cities such as Santa Monica, Santa Cruz, and Palo Alto outlawed panhandlers' most rude and intimidating behavior, observers say the streets have become just a bit more civil. Police, city leaders, and merchant organizations say there's a clear correlation between demanding better behavior from beggars and getting it. Aggressive behavior is down, and so are complaints, they say. Once you get standards, the word on the street gets out very quickly, said Neil Coonerty, a former Santa Cruz city councilman who voted for extensive restrictions on panhandling in 1994, not to mention sitting. That's my addition. Getting back to the story. The aggressive stuff, according to Neil, has stopped to a large extent. Most cities are loath to pass or enforce blanket bans on begging because some courts have ruled that panhandling is protected by the First Amendment. Instead, cities have targeted panhandlers' most vexing habits: panhandling after dark, around ATMs, in parking lots, following or swearing at people who refuse to give money, sitting or lying on the sidewalk. Interrupting the article by Holly Heiser in the Mercury News, sitting or lying on the sidewalk, that is not panhandling. I don't know if you call that a vexing habit. They want panhandlers to stand up and get in your face. This has always been a curious question for me. Getting back to the article, homeless advocates say these laws drive people out of town without solving the problems that force them to beg. But to the public, it often feels like the laws haven't even improved panhandlers' behavior, much less gotten rid of them. They're slightly better, but they're still obnoxious, and they still say horrible things, sexually suggestive things. It's repulsive, said Odette Mock. My goodness, Odette Mock is getting quoted in both of these articles I just read you. Said Odette Mock, a downtown Palo Alto merchant. Assessing the effectiveness of the laws is difficult because none of the cities contacted by the Mercury News tracks complaints about panhandling. Despite the lack of anything more than anecdotal evidence that the laws work, cities continue to pass ordinances regarding street behavior, spurred by mounting complaints and encouraged by the success of other cities in the courts. After Seattle's ban against sitting and lying on sidewalks survived a court challenge, for example, Palo Alto passed a sit-lie ban on University Avenue in March, and San Jose will take up the issue Tuesday. Also on Tuesday, Mountain View will consider laws making it illegal to solicit from people in their cars. And that is what I wanted to talk to you about. This article goes on at some length, and for those who are interested, pick up the Saturday Mercury News of April 5th. It's the headline, well, it's below the fold story, Panhandlers Obey New Laws, Leaders Say. And in the back, there's a little chart about the panhandling laws in different cities. It's kind of interesting to read, and I may read that to you. More to the point, San Jose, day after tomorrow, is considering a law prohibiting sitting or lying on public sidewalks, and Mountain View is considering a law barring soliciting on road medians and in parking lots. What that means is those folks with the signs who stand out on the roads are going to be barred. I'd like to see some really clear statistical evidence that there is a traffic danger or a harassment problem going on there. They never were able to show even a shadow of such a problem in spite of this newspaper testimony from merchant Odette Mock of Palo Alto in the Palo Alto debate. They claimed they were passing the Palo Alto sit law because of the danger of tripping, the menace of tripping, but they could never cite one instance where it happened, nor was there even any public testimony. Apparently, Odette Mock didn't make it to the public testimony section, which went on, actually, for a total of 5 or 6 hours, if you consider the amount of testimony that went on around this bill. The first First time it came up was last June and July, and then it came up again in January, and then it came up in March. So if you're interested in counter demonstrations or testimony at the city council around the San Jose issue, because I think that I may go to San Jose on Tuesday, much as I'd like to have my have a few words to the give my few choice comments to city council, and usually do every second and fourth Tuesday when the Santa Cruz City Council has its meeting. San Jose on Tuesday is considering its own sit-lie law, and that is something that really we have to give them support. I should say give the victims support on. So if you're interested in this, give me a call at, yes, that old favorite number, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Now, getting closer to home, one topic we've been following, well, we followed regularly for the last couple years on this show, but haven't done too much with recently, is the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, or the Hopeless Citizens Committee to Manipulate the Homeless, or to Use the Homeless, as I've sometimes called it, CCH. This is a group that owns the property, which used to be the site of the Coral Street Open Air Shelter at Highway 1 and River Street. This property has been closed down for a year and a half, allegedly so that it's the $1.3 million, or is it closer to $2 million, community house trailer project can be built, that is to say, installed. And CCH has been entangled in auditing problems, in problems with the city. The whole nature of the project was called into question by homeless activists throughout the last year and a half, particularly since it replaced the campground, which served five times as many people as this project is slated to serve, 40 people. Well, with me here, I have a board member of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, Becky Johnson. I call her Beggarbacker Becky because she's the only member of the board, or one of the few, I would have to say really at this point, really the only member that has consistently supported such things as open meetings, the right of people to make recordings of those meetings, mainly the priority of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless to be for homeless people in terms of the greatest number of homeless people at the campground. And Becky, there's been a lot of turmoil. You've lost the head of Community House resigned, or was laid off, I'm not quite sure which, Frank Pusilek, under a cloud generated by publicity from the Santa Cruz Sentinel. What's happening with the Citizens Committee for the Homeless? So when is this so-called community house going to open? What's going on with the campground? And we've heard that Paul Lee has resigned. Brief us on all this.
Yeah, well, Citizens Committee for the Homeless is undergoing what I would call a restructuring. At our last board meeting, longtime chair Paul Lee resigned. I believe he did so primarily because of some disputes he'd had with members of the Homeless Garden Project, which he was one of the founders of.
Let me interrupt you for just a moment. The Homeless Garden Project, of course, has been recently denied any significant time to move to a new site as the city council moves to zip out the property from under it and sell it at a hefty profit. What's that? Can you want to comment on that, too?
Well, that's really kind of mysterious to me, why the city decided rather suddenly to sell this Pelton Street property. Early on I heard comments that, well, we need more open space for ball playing fields and the like, the city of Santa Cruz's budget is not in such dire need that they are just have to sell this property at this point in time. I think that there are some other politics a work in the city council, and they've basically pulled the rug out from under the Homeless Garden Project, at least at the Pelton Avenue site.
Now, the Homeless Garden Project, the ISSP, the Interface Satellite Shelter Project, which is emergency shelter, which is gradually, of course, descending to a very low number. I think it's at 60 now. It's going to go down to 30 by the end of April. And I guess you're on that subcommittee too, Becky. These are two prongs of the CCH, and the third prong is their community house project, which actually is, I guess, getting most of the money. They're getting all kinds of funding grants from the federal government and so forth, and it isn't going anywhere at the moment. What's happening with community house?
Community house is the construction of community house has been turned over to Mercy Charities, and they are basically at this point awaiting the final funding to come into place. They won't begin construction until every dollar is in their accounts. And last I heard, there was about $150,000 shortfall that I believe city officials are scrambling to fill. This is important because Community House was able to garner a HUD grant, and which is federal dollars for the fund. There are a lot of restrictions on how that federal money can be spent, which is probably one of the reasons why it's a transitional housing project for homeless people, with the intention of doing more than just providing shelter, but helping people transition out of homelessness.
But how does this affect people who need shelter now? I mean, you have hundreds and hundreds of homeless people. You were concerned with, opening up this area, which is supposed to be designed for community house, until community house starts getting built, which now may be as late as, if it starts at all, January or February of 1998. You were going to work on the so-called Safe Haven project proposed by the prior director of the community house, Frank Pusluk, who has since resigned under a cloud. What's going on with that?
Well, I was spearheading the committee, Safe Haven committee, to reopen the campground at the Coral Street site, since it was taking so long for community house construction to start. In my mind, there's no reason why
they actually began community house construction back in 1991. They ousted campers in 1991, saying they were going to construct it in January of 1992, and of course that's that's a while ago.
It's a long, shabby story, really, and CCH has certainly taken its black marks for some of their how they've treated homeless people in the past. We have an extremely critical shelter emergency here in the city of Santa Cruz and the county as well, and we just can't afford to, in my view, we can't afford to let a potential site that could provide shelter for homeless people to go unused.
There was also a political dimension here. You were, I believe, when we spoke about this at some point in the past, you told me that bringing this issue to the city council, even if the city council voted it down, saying that the Citizens Committee for the Homeless was willing to run a safe haven shelter if they were funded, would put the pressure and the spotlight on city council to find some other place or undertake some other project.
Well, that was one of the ideas that was batted around. Ultimately, Citizens Committee for the Homeless decided not to go ahead with the Safe Haven program at Coral Street.
Wasn't that the result of a double-dealing backstab by Councilmember Catherine Byers, a member of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, a purported liberal, and yet someone who first said on the subcommittee that she thought the project was completely feasible except it wouldn't be passed politically by the City Council, and then turned around and said exactly the opposite at the Citizens Committee for the Homeless board meeting?
Well, at the board meeting, Safe Haven was not given much time at all. There were such other pressing matters that...
What did Byers say?
She did say that that it wasn't feasible, which was really not accurate, in the sense that we had put together a program that was feasible in the sense that it was affordable, that it had all the elements necessary, like insurance and monitoring and staffing, et cetera, things that would make it a legal campground, a very low cost. We had pretty much anticipated all of the problems that we've encountered in the past or that we might encounter, had a plan for dealing with those issues.
In fact, did she not misstate this whole thing? She told, I was at the subcommittee meeting, I wasn't at the board meeting, you were at the board meeting, the subcommittee meeting, she led the majority at the subcommittee in saying, we can't do this because even though it's feasible, it's not politically possible. At the board meeting, she claimed it wasn't even feasible in violation of the facts founded by her subcommittee, which she had earlier voted, in fact, in favor of. She had never voted it wasn't feasible in the subcommittee.
Well, my take on it is regarding Catherine Byers is that a campground at Coral Street is such a hot potato for City Council that she did not feel there was the support on City Council to reopen the campground, and therefore she didn't want to support it. CCH has some other major problems. We have some funding shortfalls in all of our programs. We've just hired an executive director who hopefully will give us some direction on.
Now, is this a function of corruption, or is this a function of mismanagement, or is this a function of not getting adequate funding? I mean, what about the story in the Sentinel that the three stories, in fact, that Frank Pucelik, the former community house director, was embezzling money? Actually, they didn't use the word embezzle, but they implied as much. I don't believe this from my own investigations. I think Pucelik is probably the best thing that came along for both the homeless and CCH around the campground issue and even around the community house issue, which I disagree with them on. But what happened with that? Why the shortfall, and what about Pucelik?
Well, shortfall undoubtedly had some more to do with mismanagement than with any kind of corruption. I don't know anyone at CCH that is being financially remunerated through their work, with the possible exception of Daryl Darling, who is no longer with us.
What about Pucelik?
Robert, you know that I have supported Frank Pucelik throughout this entire ordeal. I felt that that it was a mistake for Citizens Committee for the Homeless to ask him to leave, that he did a more than adequate job.
Wasn't it more than a mistake? Wasn't it the fact that they were scapegoating him so that they could maintain their own lily-white position when, in fact, they were responsible for the problems that arisen? They simply threw him to the wolves?
And another factor that outraged me was that we had a donor who offered $100,000 to the Homeless Garden Project.
You know who the donor was?
That was Jim Edmonds.
Brother of one of the board directors, Bob Edmonds?
Yeah, Bob Edmonds is a new member on the board of directors. And one of the strings attached to this money was to fire Frank Pucelik. And
in response to that, did not Paul Lee resign at some point? He's, because Edmonds demanded that the entire agenda be dictated?
I think what actually happened was that there was some negotiations and he withdrew that requirement. However, Frank was then fired as well. So
why did Lee resign?
I can't help but think that that donation was a factor in the firing of Frank Pucelik, whether it was overtly stated or not.
Lee, why did Lee resign?
I said that because he'd had some difficulties with the Homeless
Garden. Oh, so it had nothing to do with this donation? It had nothing to do with control by Edmonds?
No. Those issues had been worked out previous to the board meeting and previous to that meeting, that Edmonds had withdrawn that requirement, and there were some other demands that Edmonds had made, and he, after meeting with several members of CCH and a meeting before the meeting, had ironed out a lot of the differences. Many of the suggestions that Jim Edmonds had for us were very positive and reasonable for CCH to get out of the woes that we're in. But some of his tactics were a little heavy-handed, and I was very concerned about that he wanted to close meetings to the public. And I firmly believe that the one board meeting a month that we have should be open to the public, have public input, and especially homeless input. It is Citizens Committee for the Homeless. We need to hear from homeless people about what their concerns are.
Well, closed meetings seem to be all the rage. For instance, the Homeless Community Resource Center, the other major service provider for homeless people in Santa Cruz, which provides the lockers and the free meal and the Homeless Community Resource Center during the day, has declared its meetings are closed, that you won't be allowed to go to them unless you go through Karen Gillette and convince her that you have something that she wants heard at that meeting. So that seems to be the rage. And also, it's important for people to know, why is the CCH worth talking about? I mean, hey, this is a bunch of bureaucrats or do-gooders, maybe Samaritans who have their own agenda and have the ear of the city council and also access to the wallet of the city council, but apparently they don't really want to consult too much with homeless people. So why should we be concerned about them? Well, they are the monopoly service provider for homeless people. They're the people who do get all the bucks. They're the people who have the say and the power as to what happens to homeless people in this community until homeless people themselves take that power away from them, which it's a difficult row to hoe for homeless people. Any final comments?
Well, I wish the community at large would see the validity of having a campground open for homeless people, how that would be a win-win situation for the homeless and for the community alike. Many of the downtown merchants are upset about the presence of homeless people in front of their stores. If we had a 24-hour campground, many homeless people would have a place to stay other than just in public places. It's a rational, humane, and inexpensive temporary emergency measure for the situation we have with not enough shelter space for the homeless.
Well, I think that, you know, it can also be argued from the devil's advocate point of view that you establish a campground and more people will come to Santa Cruz, particularly since Santa Cruz is already a transient point where people kind of travel up and down the coast. That is, I think, an argument you have to really contend with, and it's not true for hardcore homeless people. They stay in their own home cities a lot, but for the rest of the folks, counterculture folks who move around, campground would be an ideal thing.
Well, yes, what you're talking about is the magnet theory, that if we provide any services for homeless people, we will attract homeless people from all over the nation here. That's been largely disproved. We don't have any really statistical evidence that that has happened in other cities. Frankly, if there is someone who comes from outside the city and then they come into our city that's homeless and are helped, I don't have a problem with that. I don't see where the harm is in that. And that's basically a rationalization to do nothing at all for the homeless.
Still, it doesn't address the issue of which merchants are concerned about. Will more people come to town or stay in town longer or make more use of social services if Santa Cruz alone opens up, let's say, a campground? This is an argument that has been used against a campground, indeed against changing the sleeping ban, which is seems to me a basic humanitarian minimum. You don't arrest people for sleeping if you don't have facilities, but that's the same kind of argument.
Well, you know, if we had enough shelter space for just the homeless that we have here in our city, there's a percentage of homeless. If either there are statistics for what percentage of any given population is homeless across the nation, it's between 1 and 3%. In the city of Santa Cruz, 1% would be 500 people. So if we get to the point where we're providing shelter space for more than 500 people, then maybe we can start talking about a magnet theory. But until then, we're only taking care, we're not even taking care of our own homeless at this point in time. And so I put no credence at all in this so-called magnet theory.
Now, you also are, I understand you're going to be doing regular appearances at the in a Homeless Community Resource Center, ISSP program, to take complaints about concerns about people who need shelter. Are you going to be actually out there at the Homeless Community Resource Center talking to homeless people?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, I'm on the ISSP subcommittee. I just found out that I'm on this subcommittee, and so I haven't met even once with my fellow subcommittee members. However, I think the ISSP program is a good program in many ways, but it's got some problems. I've been getting a lot of feedback from people in the program, some who were treated well and some who were treated poorly. This is something I need to investigate, and there's the only way I'm going to investigate it is if I go down and talk to homeless people. And
I wasn't thinking more in terms of an investigation. I was thinking more in terms of regular input from people who use this program and who have no way to really contact their people who are running it, other than call a message machine.
Well, you know, I haven't really gotten my feet wet into this, but I intend to, and I'm certainly interested in what people who've been involved in the program have to say about how it can be improved.
In the meantime, if you have a problem and you're in one of these programs, whether it's with the Homeless Community Resource Center, Karen Gillette's programs, or if you're not getting proper treatment or have some concerns about what's going on with the ISSP program, the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, the nightly sleep on the floor of the churches and be grateful, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I'll pass this on to the powers that be. Updates on my own concerns. I was trying to open up the meetings of the Homeless Community Resource Center and have not been able to succeed so far. The chairman of the board, Maggie McKay, has not responded to two letters which I sent her in the last month. Apparently they've had a board meeting since, which they haven't told me about or announced to the public generally. And that appears to be the continuing practice. Former Mayor Don Lane, who sits on their board, has said he wants to mediate this and talk it out and so forth. But I haven't heard from him in several weeks either, although he has been out of town. And as far as I can see, they're ignoring the issue. So if you want these board meetings open, you got to tell them so and get in touch with me if you want to find out how to do that. You can also call them up directly, of course, if you can ever get them. Karen Gillette's number is 458-6020. Neil Coonerty was in the news, as you heard, supporting the anti-panhandling laws which are coming up in San Jose and Mountain View, actually anti-sitting in San Jose, on Tuesday. Coonerty still has an order to arrest on site if I show up at his store or at Georgiana's Cafe. So before you patronize Coonerty's bookshop or the Georgiana's Cafe, you might ask them why they're discriminating against me and, to some extent, other homeless activists, at least in the case of Coonerty's bookshop, Santa Cruz. Victories are rare, and we have a rare victory that came up last week when David Harding had his marijuana returned to him. I understand the plants were dead, but at least they were returned to him by the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Department in a first after he sued them and then, of course, signed a release. So, unfortunately, he probably got a lot less money than he should have. But here's an interview with David Harding, whose medical marijuana was returned to him last week in a not quite a nationwide first, not even a statewide first, since it happened in Mountain View earlier, but certainly a first in our county.
422.
Dave Harding. And, David, you have recently had a victory in of a rather astonishing and precedent-setting sort.
Yeah, that's true.
And what was that victory?
I sued the sheriff's camp officers who confiscated my medicinal marijuana on an informant's tip. And they had asked me if I was growing marijuana, and I said I certainly am, in accordance with Proposition 215. I'm a legitimate medical marijuana patient. And they cited that federal law, that still gets federal law, and they seized my marijuana that I used.
How much did they seize?
A total of 18 plants.
And how long ago was this?
This happened February 10th.
And what do you use marijuana for yourself? For what medical condition?
I use marijuana as an anticonvulsive for epilepsy.
You are an epileptic?
Epileptic, yes. Status epileptic.
How does marijuana help your epilepsy?
I'm better able to control my paroxysmal seizures, and since I've been taking Dilan and the marijuana on a regular basis, I haven't had a grand mal seizure. I ended up in a coma. That's my pattern when I do have grand mal seizures, is to be in a vegetative state for up to 14 days.
So before this time, how frequently did you have grand mal seizures?
About once, twice a month, have a severe.
And when did this? When did you begin using this combination of marijuana and Dilan?
Right after the bicycle accident 2 years ago. I had a mountain bike accident.
And since that time, how frequently have you been medicating yourself with marijuana?
In the mornings, when I get up, I consume a cupcake, high grade, organic. Marijuana baked into a cupcake, and I smoke up to 3 joints throughout the day to maintain.
Now, what kind of work do you do?
I'm in home support services. And I work for another patient.
And how does the marijuana interfere with your ability to work? I mean, they say that stoned out hippies like yourself are just a complete drain on society.
I disagree. I can function normal. Normally in work, just like most people do that are under any kind of medication. I can't drive, and I won't. I'm epileptic.
And you've been in Santa Cruz for how long?
Oh, I came back. I've been here this time again for going on 3 years.
And you were, in fact, work a lot with Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, Food Not Bombs, and
Cannabis Club.
Cannabis Buyers Club. And
so what's the story with the Cannabis Buyers Club? Are they rival organizations? Do they perform different functions? One is Valerie Corral's group. The other is the Scott Immler Cannabis Club. What's that all about?
I haven't been to the Cannabis Buyers Club to get medicine in quite a while. I'm a member of WAM, where we cultivate.
WAM is
the Women and Men's Alliance for Medical Marijuana. We cultivate and distribute marijuana and track patients' conditions.
Is your case a fluke, or do you think, have you heard of anybody else's marijuana being returned?
There's been a patient that got...
other than Mountain View, which you heard about, but Mountain here in Santa Cruz.
There's a gentleman in Los Angeles that was caught on December 8th with a little bag of marijuana, and they tried to prosecute it, but the district attorney... the district attorney refused to prosecute and willfully gave back the patient his marijuana.
What about in Santa Cruz? Let me ask you this.
Santa Cruz?
Yes.
This is a first in Santa Cruz.
And is it, do you think, do you have any estimates? I don't know if you do. I certainly don't. And how many people have had their marijuana confiscated, their medical marijuana confiscated in the last month?
I wish I knew. I wish...